tiny in all that air. The Philip Larkin Society Podcast.
Hello and welcome to Tiny in All That Air, the Philip Larkin Society podcast. My name is Lynn Lockwood and I'm Deputy Chair of the Philip Larkin Society. So I wanted to start by saying Happy New Year to all our listeners, and I hope this podcast episode helps you to get through those dark days of January. Today I'm joined by two guests, both of whom have been on the podcast before. Daniel Vince is one of our trustees and he is a soon-to-be graduate of the University of York, where he earned his MA by research on the post-war working class novel. He's recently started work on his PhD entitled The New University in Post-War British Literature, in which Larkin and the University of Hull play a significant role. Other writers include Malcolm Bradbury, David Lodge and Kingsley Amis. A trustee of the Philip Larkin Society, our e-newsletter editor and member of our events committee, Daniel is naturally enthusiastic about Larkin and his many contemporaries. Zachary Leader is Emeritus Professor of English Literature at the University of Roehampton. He grew up in California, but has lived in Britain for over 50 years and has dual US-UK citizenship. He was educated at Northwestern University, Trinity College, Cambridge and Harvard, and is the author of a dozen books, including a biography of Kingsley Amis and an edition of The Letters of Kingsley Amis. He's a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature and general editor of the Oxford History of Life Writing, a seven-volume series published by Oxford University Press. He's currently at work on a book about Richard Aylmer and the making of his biography of James Joyce. Zach first joined us on the podcast in 2021 to discuss Kingsley Amis. And Kingsley Amis is not very far away from the discussion today, but we are more focused on a different post-war novelist, the fascinating writer John Wayne, and in particular his debut novel, Hurry On Down, published in 1953, which sits alongside Amis's Lucky Jim and Larkin's Jill as some of the finest, funniest and most memorable English novels of the post-war years.
I should like to mention the late, great Martin Amis and your personal relationship with him, but also I'd like to ask whether 6 months later, if the sort of great shockwaves of his passing have subsided.
Well, no, he was my friend, though I hadn't seen him very much in the later years when he was living in New York. He was very good to me and he transformed my life by having me edit his father's letters and then write the biography. And because he was so close to Saul Bellow's widow, Janice, and recommended me as someone who could write a biography of her husband. I had been a bog standard academic, a romanticist. I wrote books on Blake and Wordsworth and Coleridge. I edited the poems of Shelley and so forth. And this sort of gave me a whole different dimension in my research and scholarship. And it also brought a sort of modicum of glamour into my life, which I was perfectly happy with. It was good, but he was a good friend, and rather different from the way people read about him in the press. He was disadvantaged by having all these advantages. I mean, he was popular and successful and talented and good looking. And born into a family that gave him other advantages. Despite all that, he could be quite a nice man, and he was a good man to me.
But of course, he had such a turbulent public image. I'd like to just go into a bit more of that before we get straight into the topic of Jill, if I may.
Well, I mean, he did say imprudent, ill-judged things. Especially after he'd had a sort of great success later in his life. But the more egregiously silly things he said, he quickly apologized for. I mean, he was a slightly left of center figure politically. He never made that turn to the right that his father did, even though some figures on the left tried to paint him as having done so. But it wasn't the case. His subject matter was partly, or for quite some time, the sort of lower echelons of popular culture. I mean, he read his son newspaper every day as a form of research, but he was also drawn to it. And he writes wonderfully about it, captures its ludicrousness, but its energy as well. I mean, in this way, he was sort of like Saul Bellow, who wrote about the street and in the idiom of the street, which he combined with a range of high cultural references. And Martin was like that as well. And it was a kind of liberation for him, as well as several of his compatriots, to see that they could range rather outside the polite British comedy of manners or country house novel.
I certainly do think it's a great loss, and I think Lennon will join me in agreeing with that point. But you mentioned Saul Bellow, which brings me on to my first point. So throughout your work, Saul Bellow and Kafka aside, you tend to focus predominantly, as you mentioned, sort of even the Romantic period, on English identity and how it percolates into becoming a national literary identity. As an American, what brought you to focus on a nation which post-war was so disparate to that of your birth?
Well, my family moved to London in 1961. I had just started Hollywood High School in Los Angeles. I all of a sudden found myself in this culture which was sort of interesting and alien, and I enjoyed trying to find out about it. I had a very good English master at the school I went to, and one of the texts we studied, I can't remember if it was O-level or A-level, was The Portrait of a Lady. And it struck me very profoundly, this American girl trying to understand what was going on in this alien culture, flailing around a little bit, but being drawn to it. It's rather the way I felt. Because we weren't going to be living in Britain forever, it seemed to me, and because I just moved from a junior high school in Los Angeles to a high school, where the world was sort of bigger and more complex, and I no longer was in sort of command of my surroundings, I was pleased to be transported out of it a month into the school year and come to England. And I thought everything was sort of interesting. And I was interested in the ways in which it was different from my culture. And that's the way it started, really. I also liked the fact that as in Jill and a whole variety still of English customs and habits, social class and standing were very, very important. And as an American, though, you know, I was consistently patronized, nonetheless, I had a range of, because I was an American and no immediate threat to the, for instance, those in a class just above me or those in a class just below me, I had more access to a range of people. And I was interested to see how various people negotiated this class ladder, which was more apparent in Britain than it was in Los Angeles, than it would be in America, but especially in Los Angeles.
Did you have a great experience of the British post-war novel in that you moved to a country or a nation which post-war, as I mentioned, is so disparate to the United States?
Yeah.
And after the move, you kind of saw this landscape which was presented in the prose.
Well, I hadn't read much English fiction before I came to the UK. I was 15. I think I had read Catcher in the Rye. I'd read Of Mice and Men, but I hadn't read any English fiction. I think I may have read some English science fiction. That's about all. And so, well, first of all, I was astonished that anybody would ask me to read a book as long as The Portrait of a Lady. But then that I actually got into it was a second astonishment. And then it was just so interesting. And I could never quite figure out why it was that Isabel Archer didn't marry Caspar Goodwood. And I mean, these questions were very interesting and important to me. So I did not have a sense of English culture before I came. I just thought it was terrific.
But with elements, of course, of the American culture, I think we have the idea of the Cultural Revolution, blue jean period, and very much Hollywood making the transition into Britain at that time.
Yeah, I just was interested in everything. I liked being outside the culture, looking at it. I was an immigrant. I wasn't didn't feel in any way threatened by it. So,
But what sparked your interest in Philip Larkin? Was it by association with Kingsley or as an entirely individual entity?
Well, one of the things I thought when Martin said, why don't you edit my father's letters? At that time, I was editing the poems of Shelley. The opportunity to edit Amos's letters came up. I had to get a co-author, and this is a man in Durham named Michael O'Neill, a very nice man who's subsequently, he's not with us anymore. I knew there was a gold mine there because I knew about Larkin's letters. Larkin and Amos's correspondence, spectacularly funny. That was initially what drew me to Larkin was how funny he was in the letters. I knew his poetry and I admired it. And I recognized an element in his poetry that Amos does not have, which is, you know, if you think of the end of High Windows or the Whitsun Weddings, there's a moment in which an attempt is made to reach above the world of every day, to find, see something transcendent or the possibility of something higher than the present reality, the worldly world. And of course, having been a romanticist, I had a lot of experience of this attempts to reach such a dimension, to have some kind of transformation, to get beyond the everyday world to a larger significance. And I was drawn also to the fact that in Larkin's poetry, he does not attain this, though he seeks it, or he's not ever to give himself to it fully, which I've never been. I don't have a spiritual bone in my body, but I thought that there was something kind of grand and noble about the attempt to find it and the admission that it couldn't be found. So that's something else that drew me. I mean, this is just another way of saying I think he's a great poet. He's a great poet and he's spectacularly funny, like Amos.
I believe it was Andrew Swarbrick who mentioned the visionary endings in Larkin's poetry, which reference in The Whitsun Wedding.
There's so many of Larkin's poems that end looking up to the sky. We on the podcast I was recording last week, we were reading Livings from High Windows. And, you know, that ends up looking up at the sky. And it's not one of his more well-known poems, but it's a very common theme. And I really like the way that you kind of talked about him just now looking, but not being able to attain that. I think those two things, the humour and that reach for something higher, are so universal. I think if you can see that in Larkin, I think you're unlocking Larkin in a way that you can understand him.
Well, I think the humour lies in the letters. If I'm honest, I very much take Larkin as a serious poet, as opposed to a poet of predominantly comedy, which a lot of people, of course, do. I think these visionary endings we mentioned are very significant, and I think they're very representative of Larkin's own biography, which I would like to deviate from slightly for the case of poetry analysis, as many do. But I think it was always very much, to modify the title of one of his poems, The Importance of Elsewhere, which he couldn't attain.
Yeah.
It was always just a breach, if you will.
Yeah.
And I think that's a fascinating vein through his work.
No, absolutely.
Absences in The Less Deceived, he's already, even quite a young writer, is encapsulating that idea of trying to find somewhere that doesn't even actually exist. It's like the word elsewhere is quite an important word, I think, to Larkin.
I agree with all that. There's quite a good essay written by the guy who is my co-editor of the Oxford Authors, Shelley, this man Michael O'Neill, in a volume of essays on the movement that I edited about Larkin and Romanticism, or Larkin as a possible romanticist poetry. It goes very much against the critical grain, where the modernists are seen as opposing any romantic gesture or impulse. And this is not the case. Quite persuasively, O'Neill argues, and as you were saying as well, that there certainly is an impulse to go beyond the everyday in the way in which the romantic poets did. So. I'd recommend it. It's a good essay.
I think even there's a certain romantic, with a capital R, in the novels. I think there's very much a certain degree of the beauty of the everyday. I think very much a celebration of the everyday. But also I think it's very much an insight into the negative post-war landscape which people of that period found themselves in. So I'd like to turn to Bill now, if I may. In several letters to Kingsley Amis, Larkin writes that he doubts if Jill will ever get finished. He mentions a new version of Jill. We know of Larkin's contributions to Lucky Jim, of course, but what contributions did Kingsley make to Jill?
Well, as far as I know, as far as I can tell, having edited the letters, None. I mean, this is something I said in the last podcast I did for the Philip Larkin Society, which is Larkin compartmentalized his friendship. And I think he kind of kept Jill from Amos in a way in which he didn't keep Jill from Bruce Montgomery or James Sutton. I know early in 1944, after I believe a whole first draft had been written and bits of it had been shown to Sutton, Amos hadn't seen it yet. I think there are elements of humor, terrific elements of humor in Jill, and to the extent that Amos and Norman Isles and other friends from the St. John's College loved and encouraged and egged each other on with this kind of humor, you could say this is a contribution of Amos's, certainly. Deprivation is to me as Daffodil's Art of Wordsworth. Well, derogation was to Larkin as Daffodil's Wordsworth as well. And the capacity to see what's really terrible about all the characters in the novel is something that, if you read the correspondence, they're constantly pointing out who is really the worst or the least bearable poet going. I mean, there's Dryden who takes the prize, but then other people are three quarters Dryden or a half Dryden or something. But everybody is put down and made fun of, and there's a lot of that, quite amusing, I think, in Jill.
Very much. And I think, just on my rereading for this podcast and, of course, my own research, we see Christopher Warner, who at some points is very much the anti-hero.
Yeah.
And personally, I do see elements of Amos in that character. I think we have something that Larkin aspired, you know, for the first time in my life, I was in a presence greater than my own, for example. Yeah. And we see that John Kemp very much deifies Warner in a way.
But Warner is a brute.
Warner is a brute.
He's a brute and a monster. And there's also an element of Warner that that Amos doesn't have, which is in his brutishness, there's a performative element. That is, I say, old chap, I mean, he makes himself into a kind of character. He expands his character. He performs his character. And this is an attribute of a kind of person that Larkin and Amos have a keen eye for, to expose and undermine. People who put on airs and perform and inflate their personalities. The friend Elizabeth, the girl who's Warner's sort of girlfriend, does this as well, talks in a very affected way, performs a certain kind of behavior. And this is immediately exposed in Larkin and in Amos. In the Monica character in Lucky Jim does this as well. They're inauthentic, they're posing. And there's an element of this in Christopher Warner, who, after all, didn't go to Eton or Harrow, but went to Lamprey, a sort of second-rate school. And he has a big gold signet ring on as well. He pretends to be something. He plays at being this thing. So there is a tendency among Larkinites to say that everything that's crude and terrible about Philip Larkin is the work of Kingsley Amis. But I don't think in this case it's true. I don't buy your he's like Christopher Warner. Nobody in that novel cares much about their studies or anything. Nobody, yeah, apart from Whit, he doesn't really care about it. Nobody reads a book in that novel either.
The only reference we have to books being open or read is, of course, in my favorite section of Jill, which we can come to. But Zach, do you have a favorite section?
There are two little sections about Whitbread, and then I have something about Christopher Warner. Whatever you'd want me to. Of course, I can't do any of the accents, but if you want me to read any of those.
Of course, if you could possibly read one on Warner, that'd be great. For those who haven't read Jill, I thought I'll just give a slight background. So it was written in between 1943 and 1944, when Larkin was just 21 years of age. and an undergraduate at St John's College, Oxford. It's set in wartime Oxford. It's a campus novel and, in my opinion, a kind of quasi-Bildungsroman. So the character of John Kemp very much rejects his working class background in the sense that he becomes a caricature of the middle class character, i.e. taking inspiration from Christopher Warner's character, but also by becoming the academic in a family of, well, his father's a policeman. We sort of have the encounter of his father travelling to Oxford very much alienated by his surroundings, very much, again, performing for the location in which he's in. And I think it's a fantastic read, and for those who haven't, I would thoroughly suggest doing so. I was saying to Zach before we started recording, I think it must be my fourth or fifth reading, but I do find it quite juvenile to this day. I think there's a great degree of exaggeration in it, and I think it is very clear that it's a work of juvenilia.
Okay. Well, Christopher Warner is this brutish roommate of John Kemp. Kemp is terrifically shy. I mean, he's terrified of everything at the beginning. And he's terrified of Christopher, but then comes to admire him. And so, but this is Christopher's drunk. It's late at night. He's come back to his rooms. He's with a friend. They couldn't find anything to eat. The one bit of something he could eat has a mouse turd on it, so he doesn't want anything to do with it. It's late at night. And Christopher Warner goes in search of food. And I think you'll find here that the thing I was talking about how he sort of performs himself. Things were grim. Still, I did not mark you, lose heart. It takes more than a mouse to get Warner down. I got up and went out into the corridor, where I may parenthetically state I proceeded to micturate. Then I knocked at someone's door. They said, come in, so I came in. There was some little runt working. Have you, I said politely, any bread and butter, toast, or cake? He went as red as a turkey and said, no. I bowed gracefully and went out. Then I fumbled along to the next door. When I opened this one, it's late at night, by the way, when I opened this one, the room was in darkness, so I concluded that the man was either in bed still, and I put on the light and prepared to investigate his cupboard. Now, this is the most curious part of the whole business, said Christopher impressively. I went up to that cupboard, I pulled at the door in a sober and sensible way, and the whole bloody thing came toppling over forward, very nearly maiming me for life. Ha, 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 roared Eddie, slobbering. That's his friend. Well, of course, that made a row. I defy anyone to pull over a damn great cupboard without making a devil of a din. And as luck would have it, the man was in bed. At least, he pretty quickly got up and came out into the sitting room. He was sporting rather an offensive line in blue and white pajamas, I may add, but I decided to let that pass. What the hell are you up to? He demanded. Now, I admit, said Christopher, stabbing the air with his cigarette precisely, I admit that he had, to a certain extent, right on his side. To find one's cupboard overturned by a perfect stranger in what must have appeared the middle of the night might conceivably be a bit trying, so I overlooked his tone. I'm sorry, I said. As a matter of fact, old man, I was wondering if you had any toast, bread and butter, or cake handy. You see, I've had no dinner. And I never got any further. It's incredible. There was something in what I said, or perhaps even in the way I said it, though, mark you, I spoke in as gentlemanly a manner as I could. There was something, anyway, that seemed to infuriate him. Plainly, something had got under his skin. He burst out into a positive torrent of insults. Get out, he said. Christopher made a histrionic flourish. Get out. I'm sick of your noisy, boozing gang. How dare you come into my room and start breaking everything you can lay your hands on? And so on and so forth, though I must say I offered to pay for any cups that were cracked or broken. But after a while he didn't slacken. You know, he seemed to warm to his work. After a while I began to take offense. He was being just plain bad-mannered, you know. Wasn't swearing, just plain rude. I didn't like his tone. I told him so. I said, I don't like your tone. He told me I could do the other thing. Well, I wasn't going to stand for that, said Christopher in a reasonable tone of voice. After all, one will only stand so much. And I thought, this has got beyond a joke. So I slapped his face, and as luck would have it, I just caught the edge of his spectacles, and they went flying, Christopher illustrated the arc, flying right over to the corner of the room, and he came at me like a tiger, like a bloody tiger. We sparred for an opening. Christopher made ludicrous sparring movements across the hearthrug, and then I hit him in the eye, and he went down. So, yeah, there's Christopher.
Fantastic.
There's Christopher Warner pretending that he doesn't understand how offensive he's being. Anyway. One of the interesting aspects of the novel is the way in which just above and just below are comparably satirized and derogated and made fun of. And there is this brutishness of on the part of Christopher Warner, which there's some part of Kemp that is drawn to it because he's so repressed and because he's so inhibited, as well as shy and fearful, and because he has no luxuriance or lustrousness, but Warner has these things, that there's some part of him that's drawn to this. That's why I liked that bit, or I thought it was interesting.
Fantastic. No, I certainly agree. I think it's very much a point of inspiration on both ways, isn't it? Because I think in regard to being studious, I think Kemp is very much an inspiration for Warner. In regard to being brutishness, as you say, I think very much Kemp is influenced by Warner in very different ways. And I think that very much rubs off on Kemp's character. And I think that there is a certain section which, if I may read, I think it very much reflects Kemp's developed character in the later stages of the novel. So I believe it's the penultimate chapter. Yeah, I think this is the point in the novel where it's the climax of the absurdity. I think throughout the novel we have very, very various directions, and the reader would question where Kemp is going to end up. He makes the correspondence, the link with Whitbread, the scholarship boy, the Yorkshire scholarship boy, who in this section is very much defiled. So he visits Whitbread's room, and it goes as follows. So, after doing the blackout, he went on no particular impulse of friendliness up to Whitbread's room. It was empty, and the fire had not been lit. John remembered seeing Whitbread at breakfast wearing an academic dress necessary for taking an examination. One of the question papers lay on the table. John glanced through it. It was meaningless to him. The realization that Whitbread was taking an examination when his own tutor apparently thought so little of him that the matter had not even been mentioned made him particularly angry. He opened the cupboard door and, taking out the jam pot, put a large spoonful of jam on each of the open books lying on the desk. Then he snapped them shut. The rest of the jam he ladled onto the back of the fire, scraping out the pot thoroughly and licking the spoon. There was a nearly new pat of butter in the cupboard, too, and this he unwrapped from its paper and cut in half, putting each half into the toes of Whitbread's slippers. Then he filled the pockets of the jackets hanging in the bedroom with sugar and tea. In one of them there was a pound note with a slip of paper bearing its number pinned to it, and he put that in his own pocketbook. As an afterthought, he poured Whitbread's milk into the coal scuttle and lit the fire. So I think this is something I've picked up. I'm not entirely sure if this happened in Oxbridge or the colleges in this period, but there's a certain element of Evelyn Waugh's Bollinger Club from Decline and Fall, very much the revelry and going into the studious man's room, taking him as a host and taking his very limited supply of cash, of food, and of course clothing, which was so scarce in the period. Do you have any reflections on that particular section? Do you think there's an element of Warner which has rubbed off on
well,
Kemp's character?
Yes, to begin with, he's drunk, and it was Warner who taught him how to drink and smoke cigarettes. Or that is, emulating Warner led him to drinking a lot and smoking cigarettes. The other thing that struck me is that it's the moment he breaks out of all his inhibitions, and it's a destructive moment. And this is exactly what happens at the end of Lucky Jim, when Jim, drunk, is meant to deliver in front of the entire university, including the vice chancellor, a talk about Merry England, a topic chosen by his ridiculous professor. And he just makes fun of everyone and goes wild about it. Now, the difference between the end, what happens to John Kemp after he does this, and then he sort of comes out and he has a disastrous meeting with the real life Jillian, and gives her a kiss and is immediately knocked over by Christopher and his friends, and then thrown into the fountain and catches pneumonia, and his parents have to come and see if he's all right. And that's how it ends, pretty much. That with Christopher going off with Elizabeth, this semi-posh girlfriend of his. There's no way out for John Kemp, you feel. He's not going to let John Kemp grow and break free in any positive way. It's part of what being undeceived is about for him, that it ends in this flat way. And I was struck by the difference between that and the ending of Lucky Jim. What happens at the end of Lucky Jim, of course, is that there's this miraculous, almost like out of a Victorian novel figure, Gore Urquhart, who this business magnate who rescues Jim and brings the girl that he's been after forever, the good girl, the right girl, to him. And they get together and they triumph. The reason this happens is because of advice given by Philip Larkin that Amos should, he said, sod up the romantic business actively. That is, make the baddies in the novel more baddies and make sure it's clear to everyone that this is a novel in which a young man facing hardships, in trouble, succeeds and gets the girl in the end. Okay, he's Lucky Jim. It all works out. Now you could say, does that mean that he doesn't belong with Larkin among the undeceived or the less deceived? And I would say the answer to that is no, he does belong there, because what Larkin was saying was make it so much like a romance that it's clear to everyone that this is a fiction. This is not a, that is, Jill is, for all its comic elements, is more realistic than Lucky Jim, where there's comparable realism in its social and cultural satire, but its larger form is that of a romance. And it advertises itself so plainly that you realize this is not real life. This is a pleasure of fiction. So he's undeceived as well, you could argue. That is, they're pals in this way. I was struck by the way the ending was the same and different to the ending of Lucky Jim.
I just wanted to talk about the female voice in Jill and the section where Larkin writes as Jill, because I think that's really interesting that we've talked a lot about that kind of performative masculinity with Christopher, but actually that impulse in Larkin to try to explore, I would say a woman's world, but really kind of girls that he writes, it's like a kind of refuge for him and an interesting section in the middle of that novel.
Right. I think it's important, and we haven't discussed it so far, and you could say it's more important even than the social satire, or certainly of equal importance, as a way of dealing with his changed circumstances and the threat they seem to pose to John Kemp. He has a sister as a school teacher in Manchester, but he imagines a sister, gives her a different name called Jill, writes letters to her and has her write letters as well. Then he thinks, well, maybe I should write about her in the third person. Then that doesn't work. But then he thinks, well, maybe I'll turn it into diary entries. And what's going on here is that he's becoming a writer. That is, he's trying different ways to write something. It's exactly autobiographical in that the same thing happened with Larkin and Brunette Coleman. And you could say that that this is the middle stage of Larkin's own development, which is as far as John Kemp gets with it. But I'm very interested in that, the whole sort of element of trying to get out of the world or get to a better world by writing a better world, by becoming a writer, which is what John Kemp is doing, is interesting. The fact that it's connected somehow or other to an impossible set of desires to be with the to have a sense of innocence and to have a fulfilled sexual desire. These two don't go in some way.
No, it's all very hallucinatory. I think the fact that Kemp manifests this character of Jill in letters and his own imagination based off his own sister, as you mentioned. And I think it also acts as a cautionary tale. You know, this is what will happen if one tries to confront these desires. And I think that's also an important point to hold on to. I'm also also quite taken in the way that the ending of John Wayne's Hurry On Down, a novel published in 1953, very much, again, in my opinion, very much an anti-Bildungsroman, in that the main character, Charles Lumley, again, for those who haven't read it, is born into a very middle-class standing, is engaged to marry, and there's very much a very early Volta in which he decides to reject this middle-class background and sort of bring upon himself a very working-class journey, a journey of revelry, a journey of crime, and in the end very much gets the girl, the middle-class girl, Veronica. So I think there's a similarity to Lucky Jim in that respect. Jim Dixon gets the financial success, he gets the firm employment, and he also, as I mentioned, gets the girl. Zach, in your paper, Movement Fiction and Englishness, you state that the protagonist in John Wayne's Hurry On Down, Kingsley Amis's Lucky Jim, and Philip Larkin's Jill confronted the manners and values of the different class. So I think we've already touched on the manners and customs of a different class in Lucky Jim and Jill. Are you able to give us a brief introduction to Hurry On Down for those
I don't think I can get any more thorough than yours, really. I mean, this is a character, Charles Lumley, unlike Kingsley Amis's Jim Dixon or John Kemp, is a rebel. He doesn't have to get drunk to be a rebel. He consciously sets out to remove himself from class ambitions and the class system, and also he really does. He gets a job as a chauffeur. He gets a job as a bouncer. He's a cleaner and so forth and so on. He encounters working class characters in a way in which neither John Kemp nor Jim Dixon do. They come from the lower middle class, I guess you'd say. If you're the son of a policeman, you know, that's different. Yeah. From, I mean, their house is small but not poverty stricken is what John Kemp's house is like. Yeah. And Dixon seems to come from the same sort of class that Amis and Larkin themselves come from. So, and Lumley comes from that class, but he wants out. He wants down. And another element of it is that he looks for a world outside of England. His way of speaking and his ideas suggest both American popular culture and the glamour that it has for some English people. And also there's a sort of sense of the rebel, of the existentialist rebel as well. Amis is against, and Larkin are against that impulse completely. But there's something that goes outside of national. The confrontation is now not one class with another, but it's one way of seeing the world, which you can think of as English, versus ways from different countries, from France, from America. And if you go later on, if you go to say, I mean, this is the confrontation Philip Swallow has in Changing Places. It's not with class system within his country. It's Philip Swallow facing Morris Zapp. It's a different. It's how do you measure the two cultures? And you make fun of both, but it's not the same as making fun of the Yorkshire scholar just below you, or the jumped up. A minor public school boy just above you. It's making fun of someone named Morris Zapp, or making fun of someone named Philip Swallow. So
so you think there's an element of otherness in
well, would be otherness.
Yeah.
Would be otherness. I mean, it's not completely developed. He doesn't get all the way there. But yeah, that's what I'd say.
Yeah, I think the sort of lowest he goes in his living conditions is when he's lodging with the bohemian character Froulich, the aspiring novelist, and his partner, I believe, is called Betty. In Philip Larkin's Jill, as we mentioned, John Kemp comes from a very low social standing and tries to aspire for greatness, for better. And in Hurry On Down, we have Charles Lumley, who is the character, as I mentioned, very middle class at birth, and decides to reject this birthright through his own devices, his own decisions, in a sort of downward social mobility. And of course, we've mentioned getting the girl in Lucky Jim. And I think it's very much a turning point in the novel. So throughout Harry on Down, the idol of his affection is Veronica, the sort of perceived daughter of the local aristocrat Roderick. And in the end, he gets the girl. To quote Arthur Seton, he gets hooked up the wife, although there's no mention of marriage. And he again reverts back to his middle-class birthright in a very position of artifice at Terence Fresh's joke writing department. I'd just like to talk to you for a second, Zach, about artifice in Jill and Lucky Jim. I think we have the artificial campus, in a sense, in Lucky Jim. We have the artificial air of academia and the failed professorial roles. So I think the sense of artifice in Harry on Down is very much the position he ends up in. And in Jill, which elements would you say are artificial?
Can you tell me some more what you mean by the artificial campus in Lucky Jim? Then I could.
Of course. So, of course, physically, there is a campus. But I think the whole element of we have the picaresque, the very comedic presentation of the campus, and the roles are quite unrequited throughout. Professor Welch is not the professor one would hope to be under, particularly in that in position of employment and on a 2-year immediate contract. So that's the sort of artifice I'm referring to.
Well, you're not saying that there wasn't ever a professor who was desperate all the time to be called professor and was actually idle. And I mean, there are the features of Professor Welch, the things that make him up, perhaps don't always come together like this, but all their elements seem to me to be based in reality. I mean, you do find people like that. But to put it all together in as ludicrous a character as Professor Welch is an element of artifice. I'll give you that, absolutely. The campus in Jill almost doesn't exist. There are perhaps two scenes with the tutor who's perfectly happy to have this student clearly not doing any of his work or not doing any of the work which he's capable. And the conversation he has with the matron when Kemp is in the hospital, how completely uninterested he is in the fate of this boy. I mean, I think it's as much a concentration of elements or a magnification of unattractive elements as the Professor Welch is. So you could say there's an artifice about the way in which it seems like the university and his education doesn't obtrude at all in the life of John Kemp. I mean, he goes out and has teas and gets drunk and hangs out with his friends. And, you know, it's not a problem at all to produce an essay. Nothing seems to get scrutinized in these. I mean, you have to, I don't know, in Cambridge, you had to read the essays when I was there. You had to read the essays aloud. I mean, did he ever have to read his essay to the tutor? Was the tutor listening to them? Did he ever, I mean, the complete absence of the educational part of being at Oxford seems to me to be an element of artifice.
I think it's interesting as well that it's Oxford during wartime, isn't it? Which is not perhaps an atypical time to be at university. Yeah. And when you know that you're going to potentially get called up or have to travel across the country to see if your parents have been killed in a bombing raid, it's a very different context for study, isn't it?
Absolutely. But absolutely, and that's why there's very little. I mean, Whitbread talks about getting on and the sort of job he might get, but there's very little talk of that among the others because they could be called up at any moment. One of them is. But you would have thought that in a period of genuine peril, when you're called upon to read works of great power and insight, that someone would be affected some way by what they were reading. It doesn't seem to me possible that you could say that would be a sort of artificial or element of artifice about it. That I mean, no one reads any book or even a poem. It's very odd.
Yeah, the only references I can remember of books, even being a novel, is the ones that are filled with jam and snapped shut.
Well, I mean, it may also partly be the fact that these campus novels, in which the work doesn't figure all that well. I mean, there's a Yorkshire scholar figure in Lucky Jim, a man, the strongest, the best pupil of Jim Dixon's is a guy called Mickey, but I guess it matters that all of them had the possibility of an academic career and really wanted to write rather than be an academic. So it's like they somehow or other saw through this or saw how it wasn't for them. And that might account for the absence of anything very inspiriting or any possibility for that lift that literature can give that you get at the end of the best of Larkin's poems. Mm. You get no sense that this is available in any of the literature available to them, but they're all reading English. They'll be reading Hamlet and Lear. And so, Lear, that's the one I wrote about, says Whitbread. I'd done it. He'd done it in school, so he chose to do it again. You know, it's no sense of what Lear might be.
So I think we've brought together three Oxford contemporaries, each of whom have written a novel with elements of the picaresque, the academic, and class war. Would you say this is a coincidence, or would you say it's a direct influence from living in wartime Oxford, which of course was preserved by the Luftwaffe?
You mean, is it an influence that people started to write about campuses?
Well, I think in particular the three St. John contemporaries, I think the fact they're all in the same space, same college, and all had a very similar literary output on very similar topics with, in places, very similar outcomes. Because you mentioned in the correspondence that there wasn't a great degree of mutual correspondence on subject matter and on certain elements of the novels which were produced. And of course, there was a great element of correspondence between Philip Larkin aiding Kingsley Amis.
They're constantly talking about works of literature, contemporary works of literature, as well as the literature they're studying. In their correspondence, they're constantly on it about this. They're reading all the time, and especially poetry. Amis knew a huge amount of poetry by heart, and presumably Larkin did as well. I don't know. And that that they came from the same class, the three of them, pretty much, and found themselves, for the first time, you would imagine, confronting people from a different class, okay, in a setting sort of alien to the settings they're used to. You could understand how they'd all want, if they had the writerly gene, to somehow rather incorporate the sort of adventure of this new experience. That it seems sort of, it's elementary, but that's how I think, and that they would be confronting the same problems and have some of the same reactions is a sort of a result of their coming from similar backgrounds.
And it's part of, you know, the movement, capital letter, the movement, the idea of that sort of 1950s post-war generation, and, you know, and also writers having that reaction to what they saw as kind of, I would have thought, a very natural reaction to the older generation, who they perceived as sort of being the people that, you know, instigated the wars and caused, you know, looking back on that generation as wanting to naturally rebel and point out phoniness and lies. And it wasn't just Amis and Larkin and John Wayne that were writing in that style at that time. Whether or not you feel the not all the writers themselves felt the movement as a term was particularly helpful, but you can certainly see that thread running through a lot of literature, can't?
It's about the rejection of the previous generation, isn't it? We have the outmoded Victorian tradition. And of course, I think, as we all know, that famous line, they fuck you up, your mum and dad. It's about making a transition into a new age. And I think,
But they share, one feature of the movement writers that I have stressed in my writing is this business of being This is an element of Englishness as opposed to Britishness. That is a sense that England is a kind of, as Burke and Orwell suggest, it's like your family. You can leave your family, but you can't destroy your family in a way. I mean, it's not, and the sense that both Hitler and Stalin discredited totalizing ideologies or total transformations of cultures and cultural inheritances and so forth results in disaster and horror made these writers very distrustful of large attempts to alter society and also to alter culture. The setting their face against modernism was sort of like setting your face against fascism or communism. Mm. You're deceived if you think that that's going to provide you with the solutions you need. And you're deceived if you think you're undeceived, so you're just less deceived. And this is a feature of the kind of moderate disaffection of the modernists, of the movement writers, it seems to me.
J.D. Scott characterizes them as antiphony, anti-wet, skeptical, robust, ironic. Those terms, I think, work really well. You can sort of trace that through the writers. Mm. The relationship between John Wayne and Philip Larkin is, as people, not just as writers, is really interesting. And Wayne came to Oxford just as Larkin was leaving, but obviously became a contemporary of Amis because Amis had 2 years out as he was called up. But I kind of got this impression, I was reading the biographies and some of the letters, and I kind of got an impression that Larkin always looked on John Wayne as the fresher, the young boy, even into adulthood. Larkin couldn't quite move away from being the older Oxford boy that had finished his studies as Wayne was just starting. And there's a few times where in his letters, Larkin's a little bit disparaging about Wayne's sort of behaviour and attitude. He describes him as, one time he writes to about Wayne being thrown out of a restaurant in London for being improperly dressed. And he says, he isn't a kid anymore. And when he's talking about Wayne becoming Oxford Chair of Poetry, he writes to John Wayne and he advises him to leave the comic hat stuff for later. And he proposes Wayne to be the Oxford Chair of Poetry, but he does have this, he talks about Wayne being fond of corny clowning. And considering, you know, Wayne's achievements as a writer, you know, Wayne is the first person to put Larkin on the radio with If My Darling on first reading on the third programme. So, you know, Wayne's a serious writer and a serious person, but Larkin sort of just sees that he kind of verbalises him as a bit of a joker. And I think that's a really, really interesting. So it's more about Larkin, I think, than it does about Wayne, to be honest.
Well, I think there's a lot of that in Kingsley Amis. I think post-Kingsley idea of him being a bit of a joker, because he was. And I think it's very much about dividing the fact of youth and maturity. As you mentioned, in his youth, there was a sense of envy, and I think John Wayne would have been, because we know Philip Larkin's character, all that longing for otherness and longing for past, present, future. It was a natural anxiety he had. But I think John Wayne is very much an understated author, poet, scholar. And I think the contemporary reception he receives is, again, so understated, and I think it should be a fact of prominence. I think he produced a great deal. And there's a great article online written by John Wayne, I believe it's The Importance of Philip Larkin, which is also very much worth checking out. I think it's quite interesting the way he introduces the essay. So it's as it begins, as I sit down to write this essay primarily for American readers, it seems to me a convenient moment to put on record a certain pessimism about Philip Larkin's transatlantic reception. I don't think, to put the matter badly, that he will ever be such a favourite with American readers of poetry as he is with English. There are two reasons for this, one deep-seated, one trivial. To get the trivial one out of the way first, Larkin is so rooted in English life, which is what Zach's referenced. His references are so solidly linked to English places and customs and institutions. And I didn't even say British, I said English. that the American reader can easily drop into one of the several pitfalls: misinterpretation, plain and simple, or feeling the detail is more exotic than it actually is, or knowingness. If he happens to be well-versed in English life and has seen, for instance, the cycling crates on Coventry Station or the trolley buses carrying down the long straight miles into Hull, all that can be guarded against. Can it be guarded against that?
Yeah, well, I mean, when first I decided to accept the invitation to write about write Amos's biography and to do the letters and so forth, I was terrified. There was a scholar in Texas who wrote about Mr. Blini. A woman wrote about Mr. Blini's preference for sauce over gravy, which she thought was very pretentious. She didn't realize that sauce was HP sauce as opposed to some fancy French sauce. It's the mistake an American would make because the American didn't understand. And I was terrified I'd make some sauce versus gravy mistake. And then there are other things where, if it's not mistaken, you feel, unless you're there. I mean, when Larkin writes about the reek of buttoned carriage cloth, you know that reek if you've ever been tube in the 1970s in Britain. But it's a perfectly captured, what Keats calls a fine isolated verisimilitude, and it's unavailable to an American who doesn't have access to that that experience. So yes, that is the case. If you're so rooted in particulars, you know, people say this is the reason. People say one of the reasons that it's Shakespeare, not Ben Jonson, is that Shakespeare doesn't write the way Ben Jonson does, a satire of a whole series of particulars, historical particulars having to do with the time he wrote. It's easier to make the transition from your period to the period of Shakespeare's plays than it is from your period to the world of Shakespeare's plays to your world to the world of Ben Jonson's plays. So embedded are particular incidents and experiences and so forth. So yeah.
John Wayne's not had a biography.
Neither's John Brain. But I think it's needed. Both authors, they had a great influence on post-war literature. And I think the representations are fantastic. I think we have Sillitoe's autobiography, which is amazing. We have biographies on, of course, thanks to Zach, on Kingsley Amis.
We need a good biography, I think, of these writers to bring them back to life for us. Hopefully we'll have a good Martin Amis biography out at some point. That'll be interesting.
It'll be a while.
I think. But when that does come out, that'll be really interesting, and a chance to look back on his work and his huge achievements, and that sort of Amis dynasty with Kingsley and Martin are just fascinating. Thank you so much to Zach and Daniel for coming along and giving up their time and just getting us off to a marvellous start for the new year. We have three exciting events coming up, all of which are now on Eventbrite. To mark 60 years since the publication of The Whitsun Weddings in 1964, the Philip Larkin Society will be holding a members-only event in Chichester Cathedral on the afternoon of Saturday, 24th February, at the site of the Arundel Tomb. The event will start at 2:15 p.m. with a guided tour of the cathedral and a visit to the library before finishing at the Arundel Tomb. And the tour will be followed by a talk about Larkin's church-going experiences, including his visit to Chichester in 1955, which culminated in the writing of Arundel Tomb, given by Dr. Philip Pullen, long-standing PLS trustee and Larkin expert. This will be followed by afternoon tea at 4:45 and evensong at 5:30. And it is a members-only event, so if you are interested in going but you're not a member, maybe this is a great time to join. If you are a teacher or a lecturer, you might be interested in bringing your post-16 students
to an enrichment study day we are running in conjunction with writer Vicky Foster at the University of Hull on Wednesday the 13th of March. And finally, we are now open for attendees to register for our fantastic 2024 PLS conference at the University of Hull on the 14th and 15th of March. We have David Quantick and Blake Morrison giving keynote talks and a whole range of fascinating speakers on topics from Larkin's doodles to the influence of Larkin on Britpop song lyrics. I will be there, and many of our former guests and trustees, such as Graham Chesters, Daniel Vince, Clarissa Hard, Helen Cooper, Chris Stewart, Phil Pullen, Wes Finch, Rachel Gallantly, and more. It's going to be a great couple of days and is open to all. You don't need to be a society member or a Larkin expert to enjoy yourself. We guarantee that. If you're interested in getting more involved with the PLS in general, then we'd love to hear from you. We're always very pleased to hear from people that would like to help out with social events, education, social media, the conference, website support and more. And of course, listening to the podcast, tweeting your thoughts, rating and reviewing are fantastic ways of supporting us to promote the appreciation of all things Larkin. This podcast was produced by me, Lynn Lockwood and Gavin Hogg, and the music was The Horns of the Morning by Wes Finch and the Mechanicals Band. If you have any questions or ideas for future topics, then please, as ever, do get in touch.
The horns of the morning are blowing, are shining. The meadow is wet with the coldest of dew. The dawn reassembles with a clash of gold cymbals. The sky hangs its bands out, the sun hangs in view. No love is all that was hopeless and kept me from sleeping is pale and unsure, but never so brilliant, neither so silent, nor so unearthly as earth grown before. Never so brilliant, neither so silent.